This is the Everything Project, brought to you in association with MAC Cosmetics. I'm Kelly Ford, aka Book of Mum.
And I'm Natalie, aka Style Me Sunday.
This is an extra special series dedicated to HIV and AIDS, focusing on the beneficiaries of Viva Glam.
In this episode, we speak to the National AIDS Trust. They're a HIV policy and campaigning charity. They campaign for the rights of people living with HIV and campaign for change.
We spoke to two fascinating people. We spoke to National AIDS Trust Director of Policy, Kat Smithson, and we spoke to Shamal, who is a British Muslim gay activist and advocate who was diagnosed 5 years ago, and he works for the charity also.
At the time, and I thought, God, I must be the only Muslim, Asian, South Asian, British person with HIV. I don't know how I'm going to deal with this, how my community is going to deal with this.
Hi Kat Smithson.
Hello.
So you're joining us today from the National AIDS Trust.
That's right, yeah.
And you are the UK's policy and campaigning charity transforming the response to HIV.
That's right, yeah, that's how we describe ourselves, definitely.
So with that in mind, can you just tell our listeners what is at the heart of what you do?
Yeah, I think it's kind of a difficult question in lots of ways, but I think at the heart of what we do is kind of a focus on rights. So it's human rights, it's health rights, it's thinking about how we make sure through advocacy work, through influencing policy, through campaigning, that the rights of individuals living with HIV and affected by HIV are fully realised in the UK. And I think it's important to remember with HIV because it intersects with so many different issues. It's not just a health condition. It's a health condition which intersects with issues around sort of gender, race, poverty. It's an LGBT issue. So everything kind of comes into that. So human rights and the realization of rights is really quite fundamental to it and always has been. It's always been something that's had to be focused on. So as an organization that's focused on kind of influencing policy and campaigning and things, we really try to keep that at the heart of everything we do.
So as a on a practical level, how have you made a change?
In so many different ways. I mean, NAT has been around for kind of 30 years now, and kind of we've been doing this sort of, we've been focused on policy and campaigning for sort of more than 20 of those. And we're quite an unusual charity in that sense. Like most organisations deliver some sort of direct services or something like that. And a lot of charities obviously do policy work and advocacy work, and that's incredibly important, but we're totally dedicated to it. So what we do is we look at, okay, what are the things that, what are the causes of these kind of social problems that lead to, say, increased risk of HIV or lead to stigma affecting the lives of people living with HIV? And how can we address those causes? And that might be something like looking at equality law. So over the past kind of 15 years, we've seen significant changes in how HIV is dealt with in equality law. So from being originally included as kind of a protected characteristic in the Disability Discrimination Act to now being within the Equality Act, which was introduced in 2010, which had enhanced rights and protections and things. So it's making sure that kind of HIV is covered properly in that so that people are protected, at least in the law, from discrimination. But then we would be looking at, okay, well, just because the law's in place, does that mean that people actually have access to those rights that they have under the law? So we'd be looking at things like, okay, making sure that employers know about these rights and know about what the law is saying and know how to put it into practice. So we'll be producing guidelines, we'll be challenging employers, we'll be working with people living with HIV to challenge employers. At the moment, one of our big things kind of with government is making sure that actually people have proper sort of access to redress. So actually kind of challenging some of the sort of changes around legal aid and things like that, because that's presenting significant barriers to people having access. There's lots of other things we've done as well, though. A really significant win for us that's happened just over the past 10 years is securing HIV treatment for all people in the UK, regardless of their immigration status.
Wow.
So this is really, like, in lots of ways, HIV treatment is treated quite differently to other forms of care, healthcare in the UK, where actually we're seeing increasing barriers being put up for a lot of people in terms of accessing the NHS. And a lot of people don't realise realise. A lot of people who actually need HIV care don't realise that they can access HIV care for free on the NHS. Now, this is incredibly important because obviously HIV treatment means that if someone is on HIV treatment if they start it quickly after being diagnosed in good time, they can have a normal life expectancy. Not only that, if you're on HIV treatment, you can't pass the virus on to anyone else, which means actually from a public health perspective, it totally makes sense to make sure that everybody has access to this treatment and care. So we've been able to secure that, and that's a huge win for us. But it doesn't stop there, because now then we have to think, well, there are other parts of the NHS and other parts of treatment that people don't have access to. There are other reasons why maybe people who are accessing HIV treatment don't trust the NHS, don't feel that they can access other forms of care that they need or entitled to. So we're now doing a lot of advocacy work around kind of all the charges that are being that the NHS is trying to implement. The Department of Health is trying to implement via the NHS and things like that. And we're doing a lot of work with other organisations that work on the ground with migrants, so people like Doctors of the World and people like that, to think about, okay, how do we make sure that we continue to break down these barriers and things? So the job doesn't stop there, but hopefully that's a couple of good examples of the kind of work we do.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you're doing some seriously fundamental work and some really important stuff.
One thing you mentioned was the guidelines that you've published, and these are actually available for people on your website, aren't they?
Yeah. So our website, nat.org.uk, has a very long list of publications, and we do all sorts of different bits of work. So anything from kind of research reports, highlighting the issues, policy briefings, some of which people might think is quite dry, but there's also some really good stuff in there, I think. But there's a lot of guides for people living with HIV. There's guides for employers. And also knowing your rights. And we've worked with a lot of other organisations to develop some really simple guides to help people, for example, know what can I access for free on the NHS, for example. If you are a migrant maybe who has an irregular migration status, there are lots of things that you can access, and we've been producing kind of guide and briefings on this that we've been updating on a really regular basis, and we work with partners to do that. But we also produce guides and work with kind of clinicians as well to make sure that they can support people as best as possible. So we support clinicians to develop their own guidelines around HIV treatment and care, but also other forms of treatment and care as well, where they might come across people living with or affected by HIV.
Wow, really important work. Since 2001, there have been prosecutions for the reckless transmission of HIV in the UK. How have you been involved with changing the legal and policy sort of documents related to this?
So this has been a really important area of our work.
And it's the most publicised, yeah, isn't it, related to HIV?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the biggest kind of concern we have with this is the impact on stigma that kind of criminalisation brings. And we have to consider this in the context of sort of an international context of criminalisation as well, where people living with HIV and people from communities affected by HIV has sort of erosion of rights, and criminal law has kind of come into that. And I think it's important to look at it in that international context and to remember that sort of, I mean, UNAIDS, for example, doesn't advocate for these laws that criminalise sort of reckless transmission of HIV and criminalise HIV in this way. And what the thing about kind of the law in the UK and the law in England and Wales and Northern Ireland specifically, because in Scotland it's a bit different because it's done under common law, it's all done through the Offences Against the Persons Act, which is from the 19th century. So it was never designed for HIV transmission. So we've had to work really closely with the Crown Prosecution Service to make sure that if it is going to be applied in this way, it's done so in a way which is sensible and takes into account the science, but also the social context around HIV. And the way that this has kind of come about is really through a development of case law. So it's never really been a conscious policy decision made by, for example, the government to criminalise HIV transmission, for example, for public health reasons. It's kind of developed out of case law.
So does that mean, for anyone that may not be familiar with the term case law, is that on a case by case basis?
Essentially, yeah. So what it basically means is someone has taken this to court at some point and it's been tested in front of a judge. And that has meant that the judge has agreed that, yes, this does, the law does apply in this case. And then building on that, the Crown Prosecution Service will have to work to develop guidance that will kind of look at, okay, well, what's the evidential threshold that's needed to prosecute for a case like this? Where might it be considered prosecutable? Where might it not? So we've been really involved in kind of supporting the CPS to get that guidance right. And that guidance is available online. But also we've worked really closely with the police to develop guidelines for how they investigate these cases. Now, the key thing about this is these are incredibly rare cases. You're far more likely to acquire HIV, for example, from someone who's not been diagnosed. So the vast majority, it's not a reliable kind of prevention tactic to rely on people living with HIV to disclose to you or to tell you that they're living with HIV in order to sort of prevent yourself from acquiring HIV. You should be thinking about condom use and getting tested regularly and things like that. These cases are incredibly rare and tend to happen in circumstances where maybe people are not taking their treatment and things like that. So it's really these are really complicated cases anyway. And there's only been upwards of sort of 30 prosecutions, around 30 prosecutions in the UK ever, for sort of reckless transmission. But what we find is there's a lot more investigations. And this is the key issue that we've got here in terms of the impact on public health. It's very difficult, I think, for the police and also the general public to understand what the law actually says in relation to this. So often the sort of people will come across, maybe they'll make a complaint to the police along the lines of, I know that so-and-so is living with HIV and they're having sex and shouldn't you do something? And we might get a call from the police then at NAT saying, oh, we're not sure if we need to act on this. Mm. And then we have to intervene. Similarly, we'll get the police who will start an investigation on someone because they have had a complaint made to them by someone who said, I think this person gave me HIV. And they'll start an investigation and it will be through us intervening and sort of going through, I guess, like the guidelines that we've produced and saying, oh, actually, there is or isn't a case here. In the vast majority of cases, there's been no crime committed. Mm. And there's nothing for them to investigate. But actually, it takes a long time to get there. So there's a lot of damage caused by the existence of this law. Mm. That's way beyond sort of the existence of the successful prosecutions when they do happen.
So the majority of your employees, solicitors and lawyers?
No, absolutely not. No, they're, I'm not a solicitor or a lawyer. I'm not a lawyer of any kind. The majority of our employees are policy professionals. So we're people who have a really keen interest in policy. We do have some people with a bit of legal background and things like that. But it's a real mixed bag. We're really passionate about the issues. And a lot of the people that work for us are people who are either part of the community or are allies of the communities affected and things like that, and are just really passionate about the issues.
Hmm. Shamal, let's bring you in here. As a person living with HIV, I think it's really important to get that kind of human aspect. Can you tell us a little bit about when you were diagnosed, how you found out about it?
So I was diagnosed in 2013, mm-hmm. and I was just going regularly to the sexual health clinic for a checkup. Didn't think anything was untoward. Got a phone call to come back the following week. Still didn't think anything was wrong or it was HIV related. I thought it was something else. And they obviously did a finger prick test, which is a quick, rapid test that you can get the results within 10 minutes. And I'd had it done previously before. So I didn't think at all I was affected by going to be positive. But I knew the routine of the little dots coming up. I was with a health advisor and I knew before he did. I saw exactly what was going on. And he said, oh, it looks like it's positive. It's reactive. And again, that was it. My world just kind of shut down in that moment. I just froze. I just wanted the ground to swallow me up. I didn't really know how to process it, mainly because I think I come from a cultural and religious background. And those are the main fears in my mind, that this was something that was written for me. This was my destiny. I'm going to die tomorrow or whenever. And I just didn't really know how to process it. I remember the health advisor talking to me for a good 45 minutes. No idea what he said. And then I just left. left and kind of got on with life straight away from there.
So at that point, did they offer you any emotional counselling or aftercare as part of this journey after that diagnosis? Obviously, you said you had a 45-minute conversation, mm-hmm. and in those moments of, you know, you would have been in blackout in terms of your mind. But did they plan any emotional aftercare, any conversation to be booked in after that point?
I think they probably did. I just rejected a lot of that at the
time. You were probably in shock as well, weren't you?
I was grieving, I suppose. Mm. It's really as in maybe the five stages of grief. I just rejected it. I was like, no, I know what it's all about. I'm going to go figure this out. Just wanted to go and cry somewhere. I didn't really want to deal with it or process it. So I think it may have even been offered, but I was rejecting it for quite a while. And what I did know is that I needed to engage with my clinic on a regular basis. So later on, it did become apparent it was offered more often. It was offered, but at the time, no, I just rejected it because I just didn't really know how to process that whole thing.
And you touched on your culture. So you're British Pakistani Muslim, and you're openly gay.
Yeah.
I'm guessing that, you know, there's not that many of you that you're in the minority. So is that quite isolating? Can it be quite difficult? And tell us about the feelings of shame attached to your culture.
So just going back, I'm actually British South Asian, so it's a mix of Pakistani and Indian, Kenyan, mixed heritage in there. And yes, I didn't know how to process it at the time. And I thought, God, I must be the only Muslim, Asian, South Asian, British person with HIV. I don't know how I'm going to deal with this, how my community is going to deal with this, whether I lean on the LGBT community, whether I lean on the Muslim community. So I just didn't know how to process all of that. And I did feel almost like a minority within a minority within a minority. Mm. And that was a challenge as well, trying to deal with the HIV on my own and not really knowing anyone or look at having a role model, somebody that I could kind of relate to go, you know what I'm going through. Part of my journey was to create some visibility, which is something I did last year.
And so at that time, did you have one person that you could reach out to and say, this is what's going on, I need to talk?
I wish I could say there was, but there wasn't. I actually went through quite a dark period of about 18 months to 2 years of really isolating myself with HIV and not talking to anyone about it. I've been in a long-term relationship and I didn't even tell my partner for almost 18 months. And I just didn't know how to share it. I just thought, this is it, I'm going to die and nobody's going to want to be around me. And it was just really, really hard to kind of get to that point. It was only when I went to some really dark places, when I was almost contemplating suicide, that I thought, no, something's got to change. I have to tell somebody. So I told my partner first, and then it kind of snowballed from there, starting to tell friends and family. But the only people that really knew were the healthcare professionals around me. So people in my clinic, my doctors, the health advisors, the counsellors there, because I was regularly engaging with them. But in terms of the wider world, no, I didn't tell anyone for a good 18 months.
So you obviously speak openly about it now. You're an activist and an advocate. How has the reaction been from your communities?
I'd like to say it's been positive. So last year, I was working for a well-known HIV charity, working with people living with HIV. And I felt that I was almost in a bubble there. A few people knew, friends and family knew. I felt like I was in a bubble, and as soon as I left there, I couldn't really talk about HIV. So I decided to kind of come out nationally in the press and create some visibility as somebody who identifies as British South Asian Muslim, to talk about and create some visibility for people living with HIV. And the reaction, I think, from the LGBT community was really fantastic. The time when I did the story, I also did it with a publication who translated it all into Urdu so it could reach a wider audience in South Asia. And surprisingly, the worst reaction came from the Asian community or the Muslim community, mainly keyboard warriors who, you know, had some opinion about what to say. And they were using some very derogatory terms to describe who I am, what I am, what my destiny is. For me, I take it with a pinch of salt. It's not right. I don't know how anybody anybody else would react into it. But for me, it was a big step because these are communities who don't ever acknowledge HIV affects them or AIDS affects them. They, you know, they associate it with gay men. It's a disease for gay men. It's going to kill them, blah, blah, blah. So they...
Even the conversation about being homosexual.
Yeah, let alone that one. Yeah. In my culture, we don't talk about sex, let alone get to sexual health, let alone get to HIV. But, you know, they associate it with being a disease that, you know, will kill you, essentially, which is not true. So they would basically just use really derogatory terms to describe it. And I was, in my mind, I was like, at least if they're acknowledging it, that's a big step, because this is something that perhaps they've never even talked about or even understood or even spoken to each other about. So if they're acknowledging it, maybe that's a good thing, even though it's so negative.
So a reaction is better than nothing at all.
It's a conversation.
Yeah.
So we're going to play a little bit of music now. And during the series, we're going to play music by artists that have been affected by HIV and AIDS. And then we're going to come back and join Shamal and Kat for the rest of our conversation. So here is A Little Respect by Eurasia. Our lovely bit of Eurasia. Hey!
A little respect.
So, Shamal, we were talking to you just before, and I wondered if you could just tell us a little bit about your current treatment, your medication you're on, and what's your kind of dealings in terms of the clinicians you have to see.
So I'm very lucky. I've got a HIV doctor who has been from the beginning, from the point that I was diagnosed, and built up a good relationship, and he knows me really well. So it's always kind of a pleasure to go there because he can kind of really reflect on how I've grown, and he's seen me grow quite a lot. But the treatment that I've been on is a simple 2-pill tablet, which I take once a day. That's it basically. I started taking treatment about 2 years ago. Was really worried about the side effects of what this meant, because I'd never heard of older treatments and how bad they were. But touch wood, I've not had any symptoms at all. It's not affected me in any way. It's just basically like taking a vitamin pill, I suppose, every day. It is a big jump for somebody who's never taken tablets on a regular basis, because obviously you have to adhere to it. I have to be taking it every 24 hours. It is a regimented routine. But once you start getting into the routine of it becomes autopilot. Everything, you just do it every day.
There's a lot of myths surrounding HIV and AIDS, and actually the National AIDS Trust on their website dispel a lot of their myths and FAQs. But do you have to be, I mean, this is, I'm asking theoretically a question. When you're on that treatment, do you have to be careful of coming into contact with people with colds? Is your immune suppressed?
No. So what it's basically doing is the treatment is keeping my immune system in check, so it's not getting weaker. If I wasn't on treatment, eventually my immune system would get weak and weak and weak, and so I'd be more susceptible to infections and viruses around me, like colds. So the great thing about being on treatment is I know that it's keeping my immune system in check, and it's fighting any HIV that is reproduced in my body. So I'm actually less susceptible to viruses and infections, external viruses and infections around me, which is really good. So that's another reason why treatment is really important to be taking.
You do great work at Mortimer Street.
Mortimer Market, yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about the work you do there?
So I do peer support work there as a patient representative, and that's working closely with people living with HIV, trying to support them, to engage them with support services, services within their area. It may not always be HIV related, but anything that can affect them day to day. But as people living with HIV, the care and support doesn't just end after 6 months of a bit of therapy or a bit of engagement with your clinic. There needs to be ongoing support. So we provide that as peer support workers.
Wow. From someone who came from not being able to tell a soul to now being here talking to us and being a peer support, it's an amazing journey you've been on. Do you feel empowered by it?
100%. I think for me now, HIV's kind of changed my life, where it was something that was very dark and something where I didn't really understand it. I thought this was going to be, you know, the death of me. To now, I feel so empowered by it that on my journey, I want to continue it so that I can help people beyond, you know, the UK, where we're doing really well with HIV and treatment generally. But to be able to go into places where people are affected by HIV and it's really, really stigmatized. So, yeah, I'm hoping that the journey will take me further. But I feel really good about that.
We were just touching upon the incredible work of Dean Street, and they are able within, this is a service, this is a first model, wasn't it, of its kind, set up in London. It's a sexual health clinic based on Dean Street in Soho, very close to where we're recording today.
Yeah.
And Kat, it was the first of its kind, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's quite a, it's been set up in a way which is very much sort of built around the needs and wants of the community that it serves. And I think it's been it's an incredibly successful model, and it offers sort of rapid testing with really fast results and a really good kind of walk-in service and things like that. So it's been quite pioneering in lots of ways. And I think it's really demonstrated what can be achieved when you kind of work with the community that you're kind of based in serving to kind of develop the services that are right for them and right for that community in that place. And it's been really key, along with a lot of other great clinics in London, in terms of driving down kind of, HIV incidents and diagnoses in London.
Which were on the rise dramatically a couple of years ago. It was 4 a day at one point, wasn't it? And that was stark. That's back to the 80s and that Tombstone ad, you know.
So we were seeing steady increases in diagnoses every year, basically, until about 2 years ago, where we suddenly had this this sudden drop in HIV diagnoses. And the fantastic epidemiologists and scientists who can do all sorts of calculations that I could never do worked out that this is due to sort of decreasing incidence. So acquisitions of HIV that sort of started probably back in 2012. And this has been put down to just really successful combination prevention. So people taking PrEP, people testing really, really regularly, which is why services like 50 16 Street are really important, because they really promote that really regular testing. And then when people, if someone does test positive, getting on treatment really fast.
To anyone that may not know what PrEP is, can we just break it down?
Yeah, so PrEP stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis. So it's a drug that you take to prevent yourself from acquiring HIV, basically. So most people, if they're taking PrEP, will take it daily. For some people, it might actually be suitable also to take it kind of on an instant basis. So you might take it for a few days, maybe around a time where you think you might be exposed to HIV or something. But most people will take it on a daily basis. And it can be, it's available now on the NHS through something called the Impact Trial. It's an implementation trial. So it's all about working out the best way to get it implemented in the UK. It's not a trial to see if it works. We know it works really well. It's very, very effective. So if somebody thinks that they would be interested in taking PrEP, you can Google the Impact Trial and you can find out which clinics it's at. Most clinics across England have PrEP available. If you're in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, there are other ways of accessing PrEP. So actually in Scotland and Wales, it's routinely available now on the NHS. It's just in England, we have this Impact Trial, but there are plenty of spaces available. If you can't find a space in your clinic, because some clinics have run out of spaces, there will be spaces in other clinics, and talk to your sexual health clinician or talk to the clinic about finding a space somewhere else.
And just going off what Kat's saying in regards to PrEP, yes, there is the Impact Trial available, but it's also available to buy online. And going back to Dean Street, they offer a pop-up shop where you can buy PrEP. I think it's something around £17 a month, which is it's really quite cheap. I know we do want to do a lot of work to get it out rolled out onto the NHS, but for now it is available, and it's a great treatment method alongside people. Alongside other treatment prevention methods like condom use.
And Shamel, for our listeners out there, is there any early symptoms that you think people should be aware of and to look out for?
So I think the early symptoms when you may have contracted HIV is when you're seroconverting. It's usually something like a heavy flu. Some people don't have any symptoms at all, which is why it's so important to go get tested on a regular basis. If you're sexually active, be a responsible sexually active adult and go and get tested on a regular basis, anything from 3 to 6 months. Have a full checkup. Now you can get rapid HIV tests, home kits as well. You can go online and sexual health tests, so they send everything to you, you do it in the comfort of your home, post it, and then they give you the results back. So some people who may not be able to access clinics because of whatever kind of stigma or worries that they may have, there are options to do testing. So it's just about getting tested regularly. If you're HIV negative, to use prevention methods like pre-exposure prophylaxis, or to get tested regularly so that you're diagnosed as quickly as possible if you are affected by or living with HIV.
Quick question. Now that PrEP's available, but some people go, oh, I don't need to use condoms now.
Yes, I think it's just another addition. Before, I think we were, as gay men or in the gay community, we were trained to kind of go, the condoms are the best effective method to stop you contracting HIV. But I think it's more about being intelligent about it. So with PrEP, the way it's, especially on the IMPACT trial, if you get it through a clinic, they engage you by asking you to come every 3 months, then you're getting tested again, and you're getting tested for other sexually transmitted infections. So what happens is you're getting PrEP and you're getting tested on a regular basis. So you're engaging with the clinic rather than using condoms, maybe using PrEP, not going to the sexual health clinic. So it's almost kind of like a routine that
continuity
you do.
Continuity of care.
Exactly, and continuity of care, so that you're getting tested for everything. And as soon as something comes up, you know what to do and you can get treated for it.
Just to add to that as well, like a lot of the trials that looked at when they were looking at kind of the efficacy of PrEP did look at kind of the impact on condom use and things. And actually, the impact was not as stark as people might think. And in fact, the trial that happened in the UK kind of actually found that there wasn't any change in condom use. And what's important to remember is, as Shamal says, it means that actually people are much more engaged then in their sexual health. They're thinking and talking about sexual health. Most people that go on PrEP are choosing to go on PrEP as well because maybe they struggle with condom use all the time. Like, not everybody finds it easy to use condoms all the time. And actually, it's a really responsible thing to do, to think, well, I am struggling to use condoms all the time, so actually I'm going to take this other preventative action. And a lot of people who take PrEP now tell us, well, actually I'm getting tested every 3 months now, whereas there's no way I would be doing that before I was on PrEP. So it's actually a really positive thing as well, in terms of how it empowers people to take more positive action and take more responsibility around their sexual health.
And as you say, if it hasn't actually changed the usage of condoms, then yeah, I mean, why not?
I mean, everybody's different, and there are different studies out there that may or may not show kind of changes in condom use and stuff, but actually a lot of people assume that, oh, people on PrEP, they'll just stop using condoms. And actually, there's not much evidence to back that up at all.
That's interesting.
Condoms have come a long way. They really have. Yeah. Can we all put that out there?
They have.
Can get them in mango flavour now, pineapple. Yeah. I don't know.
There's some great crackers out there. Yeah. I just want to give a URL to the PrEP Impact Trial. That's prepimpacttrial.org.uk. It's a pragmatic health technology assessment of PrEP and implementation. So have a little look at that if that's something you want to explore.
It will give you the list of clinics as well that are available and open for the IMPACT trial, because I know some new spaces have been released recently. So it's just about looking at on there, having a conversation with your local clinic and getting onto a waiting list if they don't have any spaces.
Perfect. We can put that on the show notes. That's great. Thanks.
So demand is high.
Definitely, yeah. I think it's been quite surprising, I think, for a lot of people, at just how high the demand is. But that's because people want to protect themselves and they want to take responsibility.
Just to close today, Kat, are there any upcoming kind of fundraising events that NAT are up to that maybe people can get involved with?
Absolutely. So the big one is World AIDS Day, 1st of December every year. And we have a big kind of World AIDS Day campaign called Rock the Ribbon. It's all about the red ribbon, which you guys are sporting right now. The red ribbon is the international sign of solidarity, remembrance and awareness raising for HIV and AIDS. And our campaign is all about people actually really wearing that ribbon with pride and things. And this year, the campaign is called Rock the Ribbon Together. So it's all about breaking down kind of barriers so that people living with HIV don't kind of, I suppose, continue to feel sort of isolated in the way that Shamal described earlier on. So Shamal sort of described that he didn't talk to anybody about his HIV status for about 18 months. We know from evidence that about 1 in 8 people living with HIV have never actually told anyone about their HIV status other than a healthcare professional. And 1 in 5 report feelings of loneliness and things. And just moving away from the stats, I suppose, it's about making sure that everybody living with HIV has access to peer support in clinic or beyond, such as the support that's provided by Shamal. So that's kind of the theme behind our campaign this year. And if you go on worldaidsday.org, there's all sorts of materials that you can download, and there's all sorts of fundraising ideas. We can send you fundraising packs. We can send up to 100 ribbons for free. So you can do all sorts of things to fundraise for World AIDS Day.
And should this show go out after December the 1st?
Oh, yeah.
There's still all of that information available.
Absolutely, absolutely. So you can use any of those materials at any time of the year. You can fundraise at any time of the year, and you can wear a red ribbon at any time of the year. And there's always fundraising activities going on.
And Shamal, just to sort of bring this to a close, I just wondered if you had any advice or anything you'd say really to anyone who was recently diagnosed, who maybe might be experiencing shock like you did when you were first diagnosed.
I would tell them and advise them to definitely engage with their health professionals. If they're not happy with it, they can always change, but reach out to people at peer support workers, peer support networks, so that you can learn more about people living with HIV. I think one of my greatest opportunities was when I was volunteering for an organization and met a group of people living with HIV. It was a very empowering moment to be in a room with 20 people plus who were all living with HIV, rather than being the only person in the room living with HIV. If people are worried about being diagnosed or they are newly diagnosed, there's a lot of support services out there that you can Google and look on, ask your clinics. There's peer support workers in most London-based clinics. I think once it's when you go outside of London, it's a little bit harder. But there are a lot of activists and a lot of peer support workers on social media as well that you can reach out to, and they were great, and we can kind of give you advice and where to kind of lead to and where to go to.
So don't sit with this on your own. Reach out and engage, because there are people out there who will support you and help you, and you don't have to be doing this alone.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And even simple things like treatment, understanding treatment once you're living with HIV, getting that and getting onto treatment, effective treatment, knowing that you won't be able to pass it on, and understanding that. I know it can be a different change and routine change, but getting onto treatment is one of the best things that's happened to me. And it's a good thing to do. So, yeah.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Kat and Shamal. You've been absolutely amazing. It's been really interesting and insightful talking to you. I think we're going to play one more track now to close, and we're going to play Queen, Don't Stop Me Now. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
So don't stop me now. Don't stop me. 'Cause I'm having a good time. Having a good time. I'm a shooting star leaping through the sky.
So that's the end of that episode. We really hope you enjoyed it just as much as we did. Kelly, can you tell people how they can get involved with Viva Glam and support all the amazing work that they do?
I'm very happy to. Now, in the UK, you need to head on over to a MAC shop or go online at maccosmetics.co.uk/viva-glam. And the full recommended retail price, less VAT, of any purchase of Viva Glam lipstick, which there are many shades, by the way, is donated to the organisations that support the health and rights of people of all ages, all races and all genders. If you want to know more about the Everything Project...
And if you want to find us on Instagram, you can find out what we get up to on this podcast by following the_everything_project_. And I'm Natalie. You can find me at Salmi Sunday on Instagram. And Kelly?
I'm Book of Mum. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Bye.